In 1953, the play, The Crucible, written by Arthur Miller, opened on Broadway. That same year, it won the Tony Award for Best Play. Since then, that play has come to be recognized as one of the greats of the American theater. The Crucible is a fictionalized retelling of the events leading up to the witch trials held in Salem, Massachusetts in 1692 and 1693. But on another level, the play is also an allegory for America in the 1950s in the grips of McCarthyism. McCarthyism was the U.S. government's persecution of people accused of being members of the Communist Party. The term McCarthyism was coined in 1950 and refers to U.S. Senator Joseph McCarthy, who loudly asserted that members of the Communist Party worked within the U.S. State Department and were undermining our democracy. McCarthy would go on to find communists at every level of society. And McCarthyism, the term, describes the practice of making accusations of subversion or treason without proper regard for evidence. McCarthyism reached its peak in the 50s with McCarthy brandishing his list of suspected communists. And in this fervor, innocent lives were destroyed. People were imprisoned on charges that were later dropped. Like the witch trials in Salem, McCarthyism represented a dark moment in American history. And the question is, did we, as a nation, learn anything from this experience? Were we, the people, able to change course? Arthur Miller titled his play, The Crucible. And a crucible is a container used in the process of smelting metals. A crucible must withstand the extreme heat required to melt and purify ore. The crucible is where change takes place. The crucible is where the desired metal is separated from its impurities. It is trial by fire. Anything entering into the crucible is transformed. For us today, the relevant question is this: will this period of COVID-19 be for us a crucible? Is this a time for change? And before I go down that road, I would like to consider the fascinating story that I read a moment ago, the account of Paul's time in the crucible, his conversion to Christ. This person that we know as the Apostle Paul is without a doubt one of the towering figures of the early Christian church. His writings comprise a bulk of our Christian scriptures. His letter to the Romans is the foundation of Christian theology. In his day, Paul was a tireless worker for the faith, traveling from city to city, establishing churches and teaching the gospel. He suffered rejection, imprisonment, beatings, and more. He died in service to Jesus Christ. However, Paul was not always such a staunch proponent of Christianity. In fact, he started out as a zealous persecutor of those who followed Jesus. In his own words, he writes, "You have heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the church of God and was trying to destroy it." In the book of Acts, when the disciple Stephen is stoned to death, Paul He's there, but he's not part of the actual rock throwing. But he does act as the coat check for those who are doing the dirty work. It is easy to dismiss early Paul, persecutor of the church, as a villain. But he wasn't. He was a devout and passionate Jew. He viewed the Christians as following a false Messiah. From his perspective, these Christians were a disease, and like a virus, they needed to be eradicated, and Paul saw himself as the vaccine. In our reading today, Paul has a plan. He approaches the high priest at the temple in Jerusalem, petitioning for the authority to expand his work up to Damascus. Paul requests a letter that will grant him the authority to travel to the city of Damascus and root out the followers of Jesus from the synagogues in that city. He also seeks the authority to arrest those people, both women and men, and bring them back, bound up, to Jerusalem. The priests support Paul's plan. Paul sets out on this journey, and as he nears Damascus, something happens. A light from heaven flashed all around him. Paul is knocked to the ground, and he hears a voice calling, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" At this time, Paul is still known by his original name, Saul. And Paul inquires as to the identity of the speaker, and the reply is, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting." This voice tells him to enter into the city and wait for instructions. Paul discovers, however, that he's blind, and his companions need to lead him by the hand into the city. For 3 days he was there, and he could neither see, nor drink, nor eat. Now, at the same time, living in Damascus, there was a follower of Jesus, a disciple named Ananias. Jesus speaks to Ananias in a vision, telling Ananias to go and find this man, Saul, who will be expecting him. Jesus says, "You are to lay hands on him so that he may regain his sight." Now, to be honest, Ananias, he's not very comfortable with Jesus' plan, and he pushes back a bit, saying that he's aware of Paul's reputation as a persecutor of the church. He knows how much evil Paul has done to Jesus' saints in Jerusalem. Ananias knows why Paul is in Damascus, and he's aware of his authority to arrest people. He is clearly dangerous. Nonetheless, Jesus overrides Ananias' objection, saying, "Go. Saul is an instrument whom I have chosen to bring my name before the world." Ananias obeys. He locates Saul, lays hands on him, and when he does so, something like scales fall from Paul's eyes and he could see again. Saul is baptized and he remains with the disciples in Damascus for several days. He then enters into those synagogues, and instead of rooting out the followers of Jesus, he proclaims to everyone, "Jesus is the Son of God." For Paul, this time in Damascus was a crucible moment, a moment of testing. He had been on what he believed to be a mission in the name of God, endorsed by the power of his government. But then he is blinded and left helpless. He is placed into the fire of transformation. And how will he emerge from this crucible? Will he continue persecuting Christ, or will he accept Christ call. Today, our nation finds itself in a similar situation. Until very recently, we too were deliriously barreling down the road, powered by a robust economy. And then suddenly we found ourselves sidelined by this virus that we cannot see. We are quarantined in our homes, unable to visit one another, unable to worship together in person. We are worried about our supply of toilet paper. Now, this is hardly our darkest hour, but we've certainly seen brighter. I do like, however, how one person describes our social distancing these days. They say that the coronavirus has turned all of us into dogs. We spend all day just walking around the house looking for something to eat. We are told no when we approach a stranger, and we get really excited for going for a car ride. They laughed at the early service. Yeah. As I have reflected on this COVID crisis, what has impacted me most is the way this crisis has illuminated the weaknesses in our society. For example, the first weakness that I recall noticing had to do with homeless children. Yes, I know there are homeless children in our nation, even here in Wilson County. But I remember being surprised that when New York City first started considering shutting down, that the mayor resisted closing the public schools. As in Wilson County, New York City public schools provide a vital safety net for poor children. New York City schools enroll 1.1 million children. And of these, 80% qualify for free or reduced price lunches. And of those, roughly 114,000 are homeless. Let that sink in. In New York City, 114,000 school children are homeless. Nationwide, that number is around 1.5 million. These children depend on their school for meals, health care, and structure. For some, it's even the place where they can wash their dirty clothes. As the pandemic worsened, New York City ultimately was forced to close its schools. What happened to those children? What happened to the children here in Wilson County? When this is over, how will we exit this crucible? Will the eradication of childhood homelessness become a priority for all of us? Or will we just choose to continue on the same path? The virus has also highlighted the inequities in the healthcare system. The data is still incomplete, but we are discovering that the COVID virus is disproportionately killing people of color. In Louisiana, for example, African Americans comprise 32% of the overall population and yet represent 70% of COVID deaths. When this is over, will we choose to address the inequalities of race? Here's something else that I learned recently. In hospitals, in most U.S. hospitals, the emergency room personnel are managed by third-party staffing companies. The ER doctors are not hired by the hospital themselves, but in fact are contract employees placed by one of several large staffing companies. These staffing companies are, in turn, owned by private equity firms. During this COVID crisis, these companies are actually cutting the hours and pay of the ER staff. Now, I do understand that in this country, running a hospital is a business. But is this model truly in the best interest of the people? Is this how we want to continue on? And then there's the issue of the environment. In many places, the environment has changed because the patterns of human activity have changed. In Italy, for example, in the city of Venice, the canals are noticeably clearer. Because of the decrease in boat traffic from taxis and tourists and cruise ships, the canals aren't as murky as they normally are. On a side note, if you did happen to see that dolphins were spotted in Venice, that's actually not true. Just something wandering around the internet. Those photographs were taken from somewhere else in Italy. And then there's air quality. The air quality in many large cities has improved dramatically. The World Health Organization states that an air quality index above 25 is unsafe. In Delhi, India, they consider it a good day when the index is around 200. And last year, it frequently exceeded 900. But in just 3 weeks of lockdown, the air quality index in Delhi now hovers around 20. The sky is blue. And in addition, scientists are concluding that this air pollution does increase the chance of dying from COVID-19. So the question is, when this is over, will we try to figure out how to enjoy both a robust economy and a healthy environment? And then there's the area of family and relationships. And from my conversations with you, while this social distancing is difficult on all of us, some of you have noted that the opportunity now to spend unhurried quality time with family has been a blessing. We've spent more time talking with our friends and renewing relationships. Neighbors are caring for neighbor. When this is over, will we choose to slow down for those we love? Now, I could continue on with many more observations, and I know that you have your own to add about how this time of crisis has enabled you to see our world in a different light, how COVID has revealed our blind spots. The Apostle Paul was traveling to Damascus. He was hell-bent on doing his job, a job he believed to be important and right and good, but Christ intervened. And through a crisis, showed Paul a new way. He placed Paul into a crucible of faith, and Paul was changed. Paul became an instrument of Christ. Paul's experience should be a model for us all. Normally, yes, we are the ones racing down the road as fast as possible, careening toward what we feel is necessary and important: success, wealth, power, influence, being number one, being best, reaching the top. Even our free time is too filled with busyness. We do this both as individuals and as a nation. And when people get hurt in the process of what we are doing, we say, well, it's okay. It's for the greater good. The bodies by the roadside, they're expendable. But this crisis now has stopped us in our tracks. And in this present blindness, we can see how our way is out of alignment with God's demand for love and for compassion. Jesus told a story about this. He told about this man who was traveling down a road, and the man is attacked by thieves who beat him and take his stuff and then leave him there by the road for dead. Several important people pass by, but they don't stop to help. They've got things to do. And finally, a man does stop. A man with no reason to help, but he stops. And he acts neighborly and cares for the wounded man by the road. I implore you to take this time of COVID and make it a crucible. And let us vow to exit transformed with eyes that are open, no longer blind to the brokenness of our society. And let us vow to become instruments of change that Jesus can use. Amen.